Good evening, and welcome to the New York Public Library. I'm Jean Strauss, the director of the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers, which is sponsoring this fabulous night. We're going to try to keep this to an hour or an hour and 10 minutes or so, because you're probably wanting to get home to watch the presidential debate. But you don't. This evening is too good to keep make too short. And I'm going to keep my remarks very brief. Before I introduce the moderator, I want to tell you quickly about two other programs we're having in the fall. This fall, this card, which is out by the door, you can see, you can take as you leave. On the 23rd of October, Roy Blount, who many of you probably know as he's often on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and he's the author of 20 books. He's got a new book coming called Alphabet Juice, about words and their makeup, and I'm actually going to be interviewing him on Thursday, the 23rd of October. I have to ask probably one question, and he'll be funny for the rest of the night, so I hope you'll come to that. And on the 10th of November, the New York Review of Books is having its 45th anniversary, a panel 6 days after the election called What Happens Now, which, of course, depends on what happens on November 4th. It will be with Andrew DelBanco, Joan Didion, Daryl Pinkney, Michael Tomasky, and Gary Wills, moderated by Robert Silvers, the Review's editor, which should be quite fantastic, and we hope it will be a good looking forward to what happens next. If you want to be on our mailing list for other events like this, there's a sign-up sheet at the door, by the door as you leave. Several of these people on the panel will be signing books, so that also will be outside as you leave, and please let them get out after they speak so that you don't come up, please don't come up here and surround them with your questions, because they'll need to get outside. You can ask the questions out there. Okay, to tonight's event on changing restaurant culture in New York. You probably saw outside this fabulous exhibition of menus from the library's extraordinary culinary collection. Rebecca Fetterman, I would very much like to thank Rebecca Fetterman, who is the curator of that collection, and writes a fabulous blog called Cooked Books. And here's a flyer about that collection, and I think you'll be seeing some images from the collection in the program. The moderator for tonight's conversation is Mitchell Davis, who's the vice president of the James Beard Foundation. He writes about food, restaurants, and travel for a number of major magazines and is the author of several cookbooks, including Kitchen Sense, Cook Something, and The Mensch Chef. Somehow, that's much harder to say than The French Chef.
Harder to eat, too, maybe.
Yeah. He's currently getting a doctoral degree in food studies at NYU, where his work focuses, appropriately enough for tonight, on the role of restaurant reviews and their influence on taste. He'll introduce the panelists, although I'd like to point out that one of them, Paul Friedman right here, is a former fellow of the Cullman Center. I should probably resist this, but I'm going to not resist it and say I think we're in for a delicious evening.
Thank you, Jean. I also want to thank the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers for arranging such an interesting panel, and for all of the interesting panels that they put on here. I'm very proud to be part of a food panel in a center for scholars and writers, because it wasn't a long time ago that that would have been an oxymoron, the two of those things together. I'd also like to thank Betsy Bradley and Rebecca for helping organize this great event, and my panelists and you for being here. I'll start by introducing everyone, and then I'll just set up our conversation. We have so many interesting things to say, and an hour and 10 minutes, 10 hours seems like such a short time to do it, so I'll try to keep my remarks brief and try to get as much interesting stuff from the people sitting around me as I can. To my far left, as Jean mentioned, we have a former Cullman Center fellow, Paul Friedman, who was also author most recently of Out of the East, Spices and the Medieval Imagination, which won an award from the International Association of Culinary Professionals. He's also the editor of Food, A History of Taste, just a small subject like that, and is the Chester D. Tripp Professor of History at Yale University. Right next to me is Josh Ozersky, whom you may know as Mr. Cutlets. He's the New York senior editor of City Search, and he just started that gig, and you might know him, perhaps, or at least his writing, as the founding editor and chief writer of Grub Street, which was New York Magazine's first foray into the blogosphere. He's also won a James Beard Award for food writing and for blogging. And Josh's books include The Hamburger, A History, and Meet Me in Manhattan, so you can understand why he's called Mr. Cutlets, if you didn't know before. To my right is a colleague and friend and someone who's on my doctoral committee, so I'm going to be very nice to him with the questions, Krishnendu Ray, who is the Assistant Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University, also author of a great book, The Migrant's Table, Meals and Memories in Bengali American Households, and he serves on the editorial board of the Journal of Food, Culture, and Society. And last but certainly not least, to my right is an award-winning journalist and friend, Laura Shapiro, who's written several books on culinary history with an emphasis on women and food in the 20th century, in 20th century America. And her books include Something from the Oven, Reinventing Dinner in 1950s America, and Perfection Salad, Women and Cooking at the Turn of the Century, and most recently, Julia Child, which garnered the International Association of Culinary Professionals Award for Literary Food Writing this year. I won't tell you about me because Jean did that. And I'll just quickly set up our conversation. There are so many things that we could talk about and so many themes that we have discussed amongst ourselves in person and in email. But we have access to the wonderful menus from the menu collection here. And Rebecca put together a couple of slides for me. I asked for this first one just because this is, for those of you who can't see it, it's not outside, but it's to me, it's one of the most interesting things I've seen in this collection, and it's just the cover of a New Yorker magazine, April 2nd, 1938, and it shows 50 different types of ethnic food you can eat in New York already in 1938. Of course, some of them have changed, but up there you'll see yokan, which I think is interesting because most of us probably don't know what it is unless we're Japanese gift givers, but it's a Japanese sweet. Blintzes, bratwurst, smorgasbord, sukiyaki, you know, some of them seem very dated, borscht, shav, all those sorts of things, but you could still find many of them. And I think it speaks to some idea that we're going to talk about tonight about New York's identity as it relates to restaurants and eating and ethnicity and authenticity and some of the other interesting things that are going to come up. I also asked Rebecca, let me just make sure it works, for a couple of menus just to show some quick things. When we think about evolution, we think of a long, slow process. But in fact, La Côte Basque, this is a menu from 1980. What struck me is that, to me at least, maybe I'm just getting old, but 1980 doesn't seem that long ago, and yet this sort of was the epitome of dining in 1980, of fancy dining in 1980, which looks quite old-fashioned and probably would have even then to a French person dining. But if you fast forward 26 years to 2007, this is the menu at Per Se, and just visually, I know you can't read the dishes, but if you could read the dishes, there are striking differences in, you know, what we might call the top level of dining in New York that I think are quite interesting. There's a second page. It's hard to do this without being able to see it. This is also interesting because, of course, this is fancy dining in New York today. This is the menu from WD50, different both in its sort of scope, and we'll talk about what it means, why we think of fancy dining as French dining, but also in the way it looks and where it's located and how people dress there and in what the experience of eating there is. Just flipping, you know, mentally through the different menus that are outside, something that struck me as interesting in looking at this change, which you could see from a very formal French change to something more modern, more contemporary, more, you know, you could say global or unidentifiable or whatever the words you want to use, is that in casual dining, of course, this is the epitome of casual dining today in New York, and that's the menu from Balthazar from last year and looks pretty old fuddy-duddy French to me. Of course, the dishes aren't, but the idea is, and somehow in casual dining we've gone all over the place because here's the menu from the Spotted Pig, which many of you might know, and that strikes me as interesting because, of course, now this is a Michelin one-star restaurant. Which isn't what comes to mind when we think of a Michelin one-star restaurant. So obviously, you can peruse these more closely outside, but the ideas that we're going to talk about today are, it's like, what has changed? What has changed about New Yorkers' relationship to restaurants, about the New York restaurant industry? What are the trends? What are the things that have disappeared? What are the styles of dining and the types of food that you can't find, that you wish you could find? What are the new things that are here? And then each of our panelists will have a very different attitude about that and opinion, and I hope that we'll engage them in a really interesting conversation. And then towards the end, we'll ask you for your thoughts and your memories and your questions. And I want to start and open the conversation by a little surprise for everybody, and I want each of the panelists to tell me something. And the question I have is, if you had to pick an iconic New York restaurant from any time period, what would it be and why? And I just want a quick answer and the first thing that comes to the top of your head. And why don't we start with our historian, Paul?
I guess the Four Seasons would occur to me, both because of its pioneering of the seasonal idea. One of the things that's, I think, characteristic of New York restaurants is also the great importance of decor, the great importance of social discrimination. Four Seasons to this day, of course, has good tables, bad, good room, and bad. without overdoing it, certainly differential treatment meted out to well-known people versus non-well-known people. Breadth of its menu. You'll notice if you see the exhibit outside, there's a Four Seasons menu from about 1960, and the number of dishes on it would be at least three or four times the number on the menu now. So over the years, it's had a lot of dishes. It has not been in the avant-garde of seasonal, let alone local, except chronologically, but nevertheless, it seems to me the first place that I think of as the archetypal New York restaurant.
How about you, Laura? That's great. Thank you, Paul.
I have to go with Schraft's, which we no longer have. Because it's the place where, first of all, women could go, and women could go alone and unescorted, and they went for lunch in the middle of their workday. And New York is a city where women could flock and did flock from forever. As soon as it was possible for women to go and leave home and get jobs, they go to New York, and it's working women who in a lot of ways were kind of the beating heart of the commercial world in New York in the kind of middle stratum. And that's what Schraft's was, and it was ladylike. So you weren't in a bar, you weren't in someplace where people were gonna look at you or try to talk to you. You were comfortable, but you were eating out, and you did it. I think a big part of that is that you did it as part of your work day very often, or if you didn't work, then you did it before you went to the theater on Wednesday afternoon. It was a women's restaurant, and to me, I think even if it's not the quintessential in New York, it's a real central feature of New York.
Terrific. Thank you, Jim. Mr. Cutlet.
Think of it. The best answer is that's a great answer. I wouldn't say it's the best answer. Four Seasons is a great answer. It's quintessential New York in terms of New York as the center of power.
But a boring answer.
You know what I was thinking, though? I mean, New York is different cities, right? There's also the ethnic New York, working class New York, and so forth. So other places came to mind, such as Wohop or whatever. But it seems to me that Katz's has a good claim to being the quintessential New York restaurant. And it's not just because it's the sanctum sanctorum of the now vanishing Jewish American culture that for a lot of people, both in New York and out, defined New York, especially to anti-Semites. But the thing about Katz's is that it's a profoundly self-referential and self-conscious institution. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot to do with New York. A big part of what New York is and what separates it is that it's aware of itself as the primal city, and Katz's is aware of itself as the primal New York deli. The pictures, even on the side it says, Katz's, that's all.
Fantastic. I think you've raised some issues we'll come back to. And last but not least, Krishnendu.
In fact, I have a difficult time identifying an iconic one, and which also probably tells you that I'm the pretender in this group, because I'm also a new immigrant, and in a sense, My entry into New York is very recent and very clearly not a sophisticated in that sense. So I was thinking, what would be a smart answer and an interesting answer, and something just to piss off Josh, Momofuku, I would identify. Simply because it's a couple of interesting things. It is my discovery of restaurants, especially haute restaurant, is a post... Culinary Institute attitude. I taught at the Culinary Institute for a decade, and I, in some ways, probably even began to understand what a restaurant might imply. And Momofuku nicely kind of points to the intersection, of course, of Asian and specifically Korean, and also this regional, local, seasonal discourse, and brings together what I at least think in terms of, for instance, the what you showed up there, post 1989 New York. Why is 1989 important? It is important because I came to the United States.
And in a typical New York way, it's all about you.
Yes.
Interesting. Well, I knew we would have some interesting thinking here, because those were very distinct answers, each of which raises some interesting issues that I'd like us to explore.
Wait. What is your most?
I'm the moderator. I think it's an unfair question, and that's why I asked it, because I think, as you pointed out, there are many different New Yorks. And so there, and part of that, I think, is New York in itself. There is the New York of power. There is the New York of performative experience, the idea of existing, being New York because you are New York. And New Yorkers take themselves everywhere, and the fact that they're from here, just as Katz's is from here, and asserts itself as being such, is true. I think New York is both a place that allows there to be recent immigrants who want to become American through ways that they eat and their food habits, but also a place where social situations about food change, where social mores change, where women are allowed to do things that they weren't allowed to do elsewhere. So I think it's all of these things. And that's why I think we all are proud to be here and why we think New York is the greatest food city in the world, even those of us who sometimes admit that it may not be. But let's poke out some of the issues that we're talking about. I mean, why don't we start with you? And how would you say that the question of gender in restaurants in New York plays out, or even take it a little bit more broadly, gender and food here in a city where some people think people don't cook, other places think that the not cooking is a way to identify oneself as a New Yorker, or and the complex issues that brings up as a woman, perhaps, or maybe not.
We are a tremendously active eating out city, and that definitely it's way more here than if you lived your exact same life in Grand Rapids. You are eating out way more here than you would there. Working mother or not working mother or whatever it is, restaurants are just in our purview in a way that many other cities that's not the case. But I still maintain that we're not an entirely eating out city, and that's why I almost think that restaurants, while they're a classic feature of food in New York, they're not the only feature of food in New York, and Mitch and I have argued about this. I still think we cook, and that for women especially, the tension between cooking and eating out is going to be very lively at home. I also think eating out is generational in New York. New York is a city of young working people all the time. There's always streams of young working people. And I think they come to New York, and it's great, and they eat out all the time. And then they get sick of it, and they start poking around in Barnes & Noble for those cookbooks called Help, My Apartment Has a Kitchen. that they want to move on to the next stage, and that's why all the cooking schools are mobbed. So I think it's a lively back and forth that we have.
Sure. Other comments about that? I mean,
it's a good point. No one ever... Restaurants totally monopolized the discussion about food culture in New York. But, I mean, historically, certainly, cooking in New York is hugely important. And it continues to be, too, especially, everyone thinks in terms of New York as Manhattan. But out, like where I live in Ditmas Park, there's all of these huge kind of McMansions and everything. And there's housewives that are haggling over the price of raisins or whatever. That still happens a lot in New York.
And of course, it may happen more.
Right. We'll talk about that too. Krishnendu, thoughts about cooking at home versus eating in restaurants and how that identifies New York or not?
Yeah, and that's what I hear, that nobody cooks. I have to cook at home. Someone's cooking. And in fact, just before I came here, I had to serve dinner at home and then run here. But it does remind me. And I don't know, it may be pretentious to say that I come from a small town in India, because I really, one point of time, I came from a small town in India. I've been in New York for the last 4 years, but what struck me this summer when I went back, a little town called Dalasore, my parents lived there, and I have about 40 relatives living there, and I'm about, let me fudge on my age, I'm about 40 years old. So I have known 40 people at different degrees of different number of years, and none of my relatives in that town of Dalasore have ever eaten in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. It's a city of 200,000 people. It has telephones. It didn't have telephones when I was growing up. It has telephones, so it has Yellow Pages. The Yellow Pages only list hotels. In some ways, probably in some ways hinting at other places at other times. And of course, this was right under my nose. I could only see that after coming back from New York City. And I had been in the city I'm a novice in the city about 4 years now, though I have lived in the United States for 20 years. And and my next big book, the title of it is going to be called Cities Without Restaurants. And part of it is because so much of the food culture is about the conversation, the discourse is about restaurants. And it was an interesting reminder. And my dad also runs a little hotel where the maitre d' comes in the morning, 10 o'clock, knocks on your door and takes your lunch order, so that the chicken can be slaughtered and cooked, and you can have lunch from 12 to 2.
Now you're very just showing off.
Now I'm showing off. Exactly. So, by the way, I really, really enjoy the New York City's. It's a very kind of a cosmopolitan, and that intersection of, and maybe we'll get an opportunity to talk about, the interesting relationship between taste and toil, which a typical kind of an immigrant perspective, immigrants have always worked. 70% of cooks in New York City have been immigrants from the first time we have census from them, which is 1850. Last time I checked, which is the last census, it is about 76% of cooks in New York City have been foreign-born. And it also is interesting to see an inverse relationship. The most number of immigrants in the city cooking, it's very difficult to get their food in the restaurant. There's a funny, when it was the Irish and then the Italians. Italians had to come out of the restaurant for their food to come back in. And which is an interesting, I should stop here. Yep.
Well, you raise an interesting point that I think came up in Paul's answer initially, and that is the complex relationship between food and restaurants and class, also in ethnicity. And I wonder, perhaps you might think about that or comment on that.
Well, obviously, restaurants are partly status or power related. The extreme are the kinds of people who have regular tables but who ostentatiously order something very plain. The late Roy Cohn, for example, of infamous memory, liked to order tuna fish salad sandwiches at fancy restaurants just as a sort of gesture of contempt for food as a whole. So certainly there's that. But I think beyond that, there are two kinds of passions in New York with regard to restaurant. One is the sort of the chow hound passion, or the authenticity, ethnic authenticity, obscurity. And then there's more Manhattan-oriented, what is in, what is the restaurant of the moment. What these share, despite the seeming difference, if not of class, at least of what kind of restaurant you're pursuing, is, it's not unique to New York, but it's very strong, the sense of, oh, nobody goes there anymore. That empanada place, that's ruined. Tourists go there. The best Manhattan restaurants are ones that you can't get into, or that are difficult to get into, Waverly Inn or something like that.
Oh, which in part are good because you can't get in.
That's right.
Are waiting in line for a lot of bad things around town. What effect has technology, since you're from the blogosphere, had on this phenomenon? I mean,
well, what the technology did was to essentially open the lines of communication between would-be gourmands and status seekers to a point of something like critical mass, you know? I mean, the thing, when I was living in Grub Street, I never was interested in cooking. I never read Bon Appetit or the cooking magazines, because to me, I mean, like, it just didn't, that wasn't the public sphere. Like, restaurants were the public sphere. That's where food meets society, and it's kind of Venn diagram or something, you know? And so your chow hounds and your status seekers and so forth, like, these people are all plugged into each other now. So what it's created is a kind of an instant, ongoing consensus about where you should be going and what it says about you as a New Yorker. And there's no getting there's no getting the toothpaste back in the tube now. I mean, like, you know, the days of longing for the purity of, you know, like the one, like, I don't know, there kind of is, though. Maybe not. When you go to DeFara and you see everybody, like, prayerfully, like, watching the master go through his, you know, routine.
For that, 2 hours.
Yeah. That when you see people actually do that, that's the difference between the real chow hounds and the people who just, you know, want to sort of throw it in your face. You're the sort of Roy Cohns of the gastronomic world.
The people that the chow hound people dismiss as foodies.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting thing. What is the foodie versus foodist versus chow hound? More status levels, more conversations, more arguments.
Well, it has to be like, I mean, restaurant reviewings are my bag, and it has to be like reviews, and that more people read food blogs than run to line up at DeFara's. Otherwise, you would never get near the place, and it's hard enough as it is. I mean, right. So there, you do see common threads with all these, even the media hasn't changed the way that people use the message. But okay, we've picked up, Paul mentioned, as he's wont to do, the idea of authenticity, which is a fraught subject, but I think one very pertinent to our conversation. And one of the things that I think comes into question when you look at the New Yorker cover there, and something, I'm just gonna relay a story that I've told to most of you, of being in Las Vegas, checking into the MGM Grand Hotel, which is at that time was the largest hotel in the world. In front of me, there was a giant screen, actually 97 screens across the registration desk, advertising in-house amenities and fun things to do. And suddenly across the screen, because they had a new restaurant there from a New York chef called, the restaurant was called Fiamma, it said, Italian food so authentic, you'll swear you're in New York. Which, to me, I wrote it down because you couldn't really ask for anything else. So what, I mean, I don't even know how to ask the question of authenticity because it is so complicated, but I do think that there is something about New Yorkers believing that we have the access to the most authentic experiences in our foods that other people don't have, except where they come from, and even there it's not as good when we get there. How do we talk about authenticity? I mean, let's just start.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, that's it. In this city, it's just, it's all ego. There's no authentic anywhere, I don't think, outside of its own country. I think food doesn't travel. I think recipes travel and techniques travel and chefs travel and people who eat travel. But I don't think food travels. You're not gonna taste that thing you tasted there because you're not just tasting that dish. It's the earth, it's the air, it's the water, it's the smell of the street outside. It's everything you bring to it, and it's not going to happen here. So I think this whole foodie chow hound obsession with authenticity is just nuts because it's, you know, it's this false, it's this non-existent ideal, really. And it's not to say that there isn't a lot of horrible ethnic food in New York. It is, but it's not necessarily so horrible because it's so far from what we remember. I think it's just horrible on its own terms.
as a once authentic Indian?
Yeah, no, exactly. No, it's interesting. I think because the question of authenticity is, of course, a question of what is a true copy, which itself is paradoxical if you think about it. Authentic is, something is authentic if it is a true copy. And so in some ways, I think authenticity, no matter how much we dismiss in the academy, we love to say, "Oh, it's a terrible concept," and then we critique it in conferences. Then we step out, want to find real Thai food and real Cambodian food. And I've been wondering as to how come. And I think it's in some ways kind of the ghost of the commodity form of culture. It is, as soon as you buy culture, how do you know it's not a fakery? And authenticity is that sense of doubt. Is that, I think, is the ghost in any commodity. Whenever you get to buy culture, you're doubtful that you're really getting it. And that is what haunts, that is why the endless conversation about the most authentic, of course, how do you resolve it? You resolve it authoritatively. And you resolve it in two directions. And one is the one you hinted, which is the expectation. And once Paul had mentioned this, and I had jumped down his throat, and I realized eventually, like most things, I was wrong and he was right. And this is one way to identify authentic is, in some ways, a shortcut, which is, he looks Indian, he must know about Indian food, which is kind of the phenomenological approach to knowledge, which is intuitive, deep inside, embodied, which is, by the way, it's a reasonable approach to authentic. If people eating in a restaurant look Indian, if people working in a restaurant, we obviously often don't get to see, it feels, it fulfills a condition. That is one of the authoritative claims of authenticity. The other authoritative claim, and I'm going to shut up soon, the other authoritative claim is a claim of expertise, and which is, say, white guys claiming ethnic expertise, their knowledge has to be encyclopedic. They have to know every damn place, especially in the outer boroughs, cheap, dirty place where you get a great meal that makes it authentic. That is the other format of authenticity, which is the encyclopedic format of authenticity. And then somebody looks like me, I don't have to know everything about every ethnic food. I just need to know about Indian food because that's what I look like. I'll stop there.
Did you want to say something?
I have something to say,
Oh, well, thanks. Because I'll forget it anyway. There's two kinds of the authenticity game works on two planes. There's what you're talking about, especially with your outer boroughs, which I like think is sort of a Marie Antoinette and her milkmaids routine. You know, I mean, like the guy that tells, "Oh, I'm going to take you to the book," you know, the Uzbeki kebab restaurant. Like, what does he know about Uzbeki? You know, like he's never been to Bukhara or whatever. But then there's also, you know, the very classical kind of American thing about having the European referent. Goes back to, I mean, Edith Wharton and Henry James and, you know, the American preoccupation with Europe. And Americans, a lot of them have been to Europe, so they have a frame of reference against which to judge what are still the dominant paradigms in food, which is French cooking and Italian cooking. And now, I mean, when you start talking about Italian cooking in New York, authenticity becomes a meaningful factor. You know, I mean, you get somebody like Michael White. You know, I mean, this is a guy that cooked there for 8 years and now is using all kinds of French techniques and so forth, but doing everything he can to try to channel, you know, those Italian flavors. And of course, there's always going to be somebody that says, you know, like, oh, it's not, you know, well, no, what?
I'll be that person. I'm going to hold my hand up. No.
No, but I mean, there's always, oh, it's, you know, when you eat it on the hill in Tuscany with the sun shining, nothing's the same as that. But I mean, it's not totally meaningless to talk about Italian reference in that kind of context.
No, of course not.
Well, I guess I would say also one aspect of the search for authenticity is ingredients and not experience of, you know, this ethnic or this Italian restaurant conforms to what is my ideal of reality. I think that the strongest push at the moment in New York restaurants is clearly that which is strongest everywhere and I suppose comes from California. Originally, and that is quality, local origins, seasonality, a method of cooking that lets the quality of the ingredients come through. So that in that sense, authenticity is opposed not so much to artificiality or, you know, Italian food as it was understood you know, by what are now dismissed as red sauce restaurants or you know, French food understood as beef Wellington 40 years ago, but rather an authenticity based on a kind of rediscovery of local ingredients or of seasonality, and that's certainly the largest trend. Against that would be innovation or restaurants that have, like WD-50, an experimental approach to food. And although there's tremendous acclaim for the experimental or molecular gastronomy, witness Ferran Adrià's Heroes Welcome at an event here just a week ago, there aren't a lot of places in New York that really are absorbing a lot from that kind of tradition. And indeed, when he was asked a question about what his favorite, well, it wasn't his favorite restaurants in New York. Is there anything you would take away from the United States, from your experience? Is there anything that you would miss when you go back to Catalonia? And he said, people couldn't understand at first because he said it, in, well, it only exists in English, but he said Katz's.
Interesting. Mm.
He had a lot of trouble saying it in a way that everybody would understand, too. But that's what he said.
That's also Marco Pierre White when they ask him what his one restaurant is.
But that speaks to two things. I mean, if you had, if my grandmother were still alive, she'd say, oh, it's nothing like what it used to be. I mean, you know.
Forget
it. That's when it was a restaurant, of course. There is no such thing.
I don't believe, I don't see it. They used to ask Balanchine who his favorite choreographer was, or his favorite dancer was. He would always say Fred Astaire. And a lot, he's saying something you can, he's not going to choose. I think it doesn't count.
Maybe it's true.
I don't think he would choose it exactly, but it's an interesting experience for him. In other words, it's something that is unusual and not something that he can easily reference to things that he already knows.
Would you take it as also as a kind of a put down too? Like deflating all this pretentious, we have become a big eating, great eating city? I mean, I missed that part, I left early.
Well, I mean, I don't want to talk about another event rather than our own, but, you know, he just took over the whole thing.
Yeah, it was terrific.
He just took over the whole thing, and, you know, the interlocutor's questions, he just kind of tossed them aside. So he had a kind of authoritative, he'd been called a god, let alone a genius, by the people introducing him. So he sort of acted like Picasso being asked, you know, who's your favorite painter? I mean, you know, he's not really in. What is he going to say, Le Bernardin or something like that?
Right. You know what it is? I'm sorry.
No, please.
Katz is our Uzbeki kebabs.
That's... No, there's a density to it that's you have to approach with caution in some ways, with care.
Right.
With
care. Like when you say that your favorite restaurant is the Uzbeki kebab restaurant, then it's like you're positioning yourself as, you know, a kind of transcendent being. And that, Katz's is our Uzbeki kebab restaurant.
I'm just going to, because the idea of time and authenticity came up, and some notion, which I think plays to Katz's, that it's been around so long, and in some ways it hasn't changed as much as other things have changed, at least recognizably, and the experience still feels, puts you a little bit out of sorts. I want to read something. Betsy Bradley, who organized this panel, or helped organize this panel, had a book that she just brought because she thought it was interesting by Harry Botsford from 1955 called New York's 100 Best Restaurants. And he was the restaurant editor of Esquire magazine for 4 years, from 1950 to 54. And I just had to I was flipping through it just before we got on stage, and he described the Champs-Élysées, which was at 25 East 40th, as the best French cuisine in the city, because their chicken Élysée was generous pieces of white meat and a layer of broccoli covered with an ingratiating cream sauce layered with, lashed with grated cheese and run under the broiler to attain a color and remarkable effect at only $2.75 for the complete meal. It doesn't sound very French. I've never even seen broccoli in France, I don't think. But time didn't really give that restaurant any kudos. But part of that, I mean, I think people reading that thought that was an authentic French experience then, because that's what they were told by people, you know, not everyone had been to France.
When they read that, they recognized that layered chicken and broccoli and cream mushroom soup thing that their mothers had been making.
Totally. Which, I mean, I'm not allowed to say this really in public. This isn't quite public. So, you know, we to this day, we get recipes from our esteemed members that include all kinds, you know, who come and eat out in the finest restaurants in the Beard Foundation that all include cans of Campbell's soup and layers of broccoli, I'm sure. Let's change the topic just slightly, because we don't have as much time as we'd all like to just sit here and talk. And let's look at the question what question? What's missing in New York? What are some of the changes, the things that we remember? I'd love to hear what you have to say, or what's different, or what's better. I'm not saying gone is good or gone is bad necessarily, but
The thing about New York that is always going to be a huge problem is that we're not San Francisco, and we just never will be. It's right. Just, you know, here we are in the East Coast, and there they are on the West Coast. It can't happen. So we're never going to have the ingredients. We're not going to have them all year round. And even in this, you know, I always shop at the Green Market, please, you're still serving, you know, asparagus in February. We don't have it. And in that sense, I think New York always has to be the second restaurant city. We're just not there. You can get an ordinary, I believe this. When I was little, my mother used to say, Paris is the most wonderful place to eat because you can never get a bad meal. Well, it's no longer true in Paris. It's maybe never been true in New York. But I have a feeling it's closer to true in the Bay Area, just because they are so accustomed to having the ingredients and having the produce and they're also inoculated with this worship of the things that they're gonna treat them nicely. So I would say that's what we'll never have. We just won't have it.
And I would say ingredients are one thing, but you also know, have to know how to cook it. Christian, Andrew.
Nothing interesting to say.
Nothing interesting. Right.
Well, it struck me when I was looking at the menus out there in the room. They have those huge menus, like they had the Luchow's menu that has everything in the world on it. And it's so appealing. You see it in diners in a debased version, but it reminds me a lot of like changes in television, really. Like television, there used to be the idea would have one star that everybody loved, Dean Martin, Lucille Ball, or whatever. And that fell apart, and it all became niche programming, you know. And that's what it's like now. There's no generalized restaurant where you can go, and there's like steaks, chops, fishes, a million different things. I mean, even the closest you would get to something like that, I guess, would be kind of universally approachable restaurant like a Gramercy Tavern or Balthazar that kind of steers a course in the high middle, you know. But that generalist restaurant that's all things to all men, I mean, that doesn't exist anymore.
Paul. Well, I'm very interested in restaurants that you know, or cuisines or dishes that you can't find anymore that used to be common. Certainly, things like Swiss or Scandinavian or German food were never very common. They were more common than they are now. High-end Chinese has always had a lot of trouble establishing itself here. Avant-garde Spanish, as I just said, despite the fame of these places in the Basque Country and Catalonia. But French is the most interesting, because despite these the impression that you get from things like the Botsford book that French restaurants in 1955 were awful, there really were marvelous ones. I thought about this recently. My father was 90 years old, and when I was a kid, we used to go to a restaurant called Mon Paris on, I think, 29th Street and Madison Avenue. And he always ordered homard à l'américaine, this lobster dish that is made with tomatoes, cognac, the shell of the lobster. There's a lot of debate as to whether it's American or Amorican. It's a 19th century dish that used to be served at, if not all, French restaurants. And this is the title that Betsy came up with for this session, Farewell Canals. Canal de Brochet is another thing once found everywhere, now very rare. So I was thinking, well, you know, where could I go with this group of relatives and the few surviving friends? And we went to Le Périgord. Le Périgord, I asked the owner, and he looked at me as if I was crazy. Homard à l'américaine, mais on sait tous les jours. You know, we have it every day, no problem. And Canal de Brochet to start, course, right. Actually. But, you know, I can think of maybe one or two other places, but this is something that simply, and this is a high-end thing. It's not like, perfection salad or some, you know, weird kind of casserole dish that you'd have to be just wrapped up in nostalgia, actually, to
that's
want.
Something. I think what you're speaking to.
Separate from nostalgia, in a sense.
Well, I
what
think
is
it's
so compelling about it?
Oh.
It's rich in the way that French food is not now. French food now is either like Balthazar, it's bistro food, it's sort of rapid preparation, steak tartare, moule frites, steak frites, pâté, or it is Frenchified but innovative and full of vanilla beans and crossover and lovely and delightful like Alain Ducasse's new restaurant, but not... there still are in Paris, 1,000 restaurants at least that have these fairly ordinary, admittedly traditional, but they're too buttery. They're too, they have butter and liqueur and shallots and herbs and stuff that just doesn't fit the taste that we have at the
moment. I almost think, not that we have time to explore it, but it points to another trend which has been, is related to the celebrity chef and the role of ego in cooking and sort of the professional marketplace and the commodification of these experiences where we've sought here and certainly in certain echelons of the food world to differentiate chefs by their creativity and the uniqueness of their own dishes, whereas it used to be more about the way they played the music, so if you will, and created these masterpieces, something that I think plays into the feeling that Italy has these, all of these authentic food experiences, because you go from one restaurant in Bologna to the other tasting, you know, ragus. But truth be told, I teach a course in Italy of NYU students, and after 2 days, they're like, okay, where can we get something besides Italian food here, you know? So we come to expect different, we have different expectations as things change. And it's sad because we're coming to the end. I guess I want to spend 1 second talking about not things lost, but things that are coming, and maybe some trends that just off the top of your head we can see. For fun, I asked one of the people in charge of programming at the Beard Foundation, where we do lots and lots of events and bring in chefs from all over the world, what they four things that were going on right now in restaurants, and this is what she said, and some people who know her in this audience might recognize these things. And she said them like this: small plates, cocktails, 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 and restaurants as lounges. I don't get it. Desserts as dinner, savory desserts. Who wants a savory dessert? Who wants dessert for dinner? And bikini dresses, high heels, and lots of drugs in the bathroom. Okay, so trends, yeah. Things going on. In food, I mean, in our interest. Why don't we start with you, Laura? Things.
First of all, I think we're going to see everything totally cut back.
Of course.
And, it's going to be grazed papaya 3 times a day, right, for a lot of places. So it's, a lot is sort of shaved away. But in places where there is still money to spend, you're going to see these little bits and pieces of the sort of high-end techno cuisine, El Bulli stuff. It's not, I don't think it's ever going to happen in New York, but you'll see this, somebody will do a foam and somebody else will do, a radish that looks like a chocolate pudding. That'll be what they do for that. But we won't get that whole real thing, I think, for various reasons. First of all, it would be way too expensive to create a huge over-the-top restaurant in that style in this city. It'd be millions just to open the doors. Investors would have to take a chance on a city that has never been interested in it, that they would eat the stuff. And second, it takes, 5 hours to eat that meal? New Yorkers will spend money, but they won't spend time. And mm-hmm. So I think it's not going to happen. So in homage to that style, you'll get this little sort of touches of it here and there.
Thoughts about, we'll change the question for you, but any different trends in the relationship of people asserting a New York identity?
I couldn't change the question because I didn't have an answer.
Yeah, I could see that.
And that's because I can't predict my own future. Forget about the restaurant industry's future. But what I do see, for instance, and this goes back to Paul's comments before, is difficulty of out a Chinese place, for instance. I think that's coming if China keeps moving in that direction, which is it has been moving. We, of course, don't know now. Everything is up in the air in terms of... Because I think our evaluation of food, no matter how much we congratulate ourselves about being tasteful, it is really about other things. It's about an aesthetic, appreciation of an aesthetic, almost beyond food. I think that's why Japanese food became that important. And Chinese food might become much more prestigious if China continues to develop for the next 20 years at the rate of 10%, which is probably an impossibility now. But also, more importantly, Chinese immigration completely stops, because the proximate other is never the site of great romance about another's culture. It is the distant other. I see the same thing with India, Indian food. There's the Indian professional class, people like me who give it a certain patina in terms of cosmopolitan culture. It's relatively small. And if India, I think India would be behind 50 years in this in terms of China. But even similar, two things have to happen. Capitalism has to do very well in those places. Mm-hmm. And a consequence of that is out-migration ends. It has happened everywhere. And prestige goes up. And I can see those kinds of patterns. And we're talking about 20, 50 years, which hopefully will be out of the bottom of this cycle, the economic cycle.
Let's hope.
Gosh. This is what's happening. The future or now?
Now and forward.
To play Gastrodamus, as
it were. He's been waiting all night to say that, I'm sure.
I put it on the feedback. Here, I'll speak to the one subject that I think I know about is meat. I think that the edible animal game is getting ramped up every month, And what's going to continue to happen, the pressure is going to be such to make, you know, the best food. When you had the best answer with the old froggy stuff. That's the best food. Everyone loves that. That's the best food. So you can't have that anymore. So now you have to have, like, a short rib that's braised and then, like, you know, stuffed with some other kind of a chorizo or whatever. And, like, you have, like...
Can he say that here?
No, well, like, for instance, Ryan Skeen is doing a flap meat burger now, and he's going to have pea meal on top of it or something else. David obviously made hay doing very intense, you know, more fat, more concentrated.
Things, right.
I would say that there's going to be more boutique food. People are going to get hipper to the really key parts of the animal that have the most flavor. Already you're seeing steakhouses serve the deckle, spinalis dorsi muscle by itself. And then I think the next thing that's going to happen is they're going to start browning. Because you still see racks and pink things, and they're going to wake up to that whatever piece it is can then be crunchy and crispy, too.
Interesting.
And so that'll be the next thing, but meatier and meatier.
Okay. Vegetarians beware. And Paul?
Historians don't like the way in which people in fields like political science predict the future just based on extrapolation from the present. So it's very hard to divorce yourself from that. I find it really hard with food, that is, imagining something that's really a turning other than, you know, just restaurants closing up or doing what they're already doing, and that is turning towards cheaper ingredients. But I think the cheaper ingredients also may tie in with the diffusion of authenticity related to ingredients, so that after seasonal vegetables or sustainable seafood, then I agree very much that you'll see more sophistication about meat, both animal parts, forms of how the animal was raised. So I would say also more ecology, not necessarily you shouldn't eat this because of fishing methods or because animal grazing has a negative impact, but a consciousness, an outgrowth of local cuisine, which emphasizes not merely what farm this came from, but sort of the practices. What I'd be interested to see, and I don't have a prediction, but I suspect it'll go two ways, extremes, is what menus will look like. Because on the one hand, there's the menu that you showed us, these very modern menus that communicate very little. Your waiter then tells you a lot about what it is. But Kraft takes this to something of an extreme. You know, it just says turnips, in other words, mushrooms. And then, you know, it's under roasted. So that's all you need to know. The other extreme is, you know, Neiman Ranch this and, you know, Peaky Toe that and a little farm you never heard of, but their cheese
but
is
you're
great.
Supposed to know,
and,
right?
And we're not going to tell you where it is, but it's somewhere in upstate New York. That kind of the menus will get ever more elaborate on the one side and ever more severe. And my guess is that the cultural impact, as opposed to the economic impact of the crisis, will be towards the severe. I think there's going to be a new kind of elegance that is, you know, in defiance of the times, but probably actually from the restaurateur's point of view, not quite as expensive as the glitzy world that is about to pass away.
Interesting. Well, I'd just like to take a moment to point out, because I feel I have to defend our food city against Laura, that one of the things I think that makes New York such a great food town is that we can have a conversation like this about these sorts of things that aren't just about how locally our food comes from, but also some very complex intellectual and cultural issues. And I want to thank our panelists. I think they did a terrific job, and I want to give them a round of applause for being here. Obviously. There's a lot more to talk about and to think about, and I wouldn't like to leave before we ask if there are any questions in the audience for anybody. Yes, please. Oh, there is a microphone on the side.
Hi, thank you. I'm curious to hear your comments on, it's kind of a shift, kind of the opposite of what we've been talking about, but I'd love to hear your comments about alternative restaurants in people's apartments. I've been seeing a lot of this in Brooklyn, And it's kind of a combination of what we were talking, or what you were talking about before, about eating out and staying in to cook. And I'd love to hear your comments about that.
Now, actually, that's a great question because it combines all the elements of New Yorkness. It is so chic that you don't know about it.
You got to go to Brooklyn, for
right.
starters.
Right. You have to go to Brooklyn.
It's in a home, right.
It's in somebody's house. I mean, it's just, it combines every single element. I mean, you absolutely
well,
named
social
it.
Capital, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's both appropriate to a more modest way of life and to permanent sort of, not snobbery, but at least one-upsmanship, sure.
Right.
The thing is about those parties, though, it's all restaurant cooks or restaurant cooking. You know, like this guy Mike Serino is doing a lot of these things now. He's a terrific guy, a really accomplished amateur cook. And he's doing all kinds of crazy stuff with methyl cellulose or whatever. I mean, that is...
Or salt or something.
I mean, that's not home cooking.
It's also, I'll point out it's also illegal, which adds to its allure, I think, in some ways. Right. Other questions?
I think two things. It's a simulacra of domesticity. And that's how it works. It is the commodity form of the anti-commodity. You sell it, you do it at home. That's where it's lore, and you break the rules, and some rules you break, as you break those rules, you make other rules in the process, and it's terrific. I think it's terrific. It's interesting.
You know, it's also the exact opposite of this whole blogosphere. Everybody's a critic. Everybody knows everything. We don't need print reviews anymore because we're all the best judges of everything. You have that, which basically means you have nothing, frankly, because these people... I mean, there's a vast amount of ignorance out there, but they're on the web, so you know it must count for something. But then you have this little hidden restaurant that you can feel like you are the ultimate expert and you're the smartest person in the room because you got there. So it differentiates you already from all this knowledge that's supposedly out there.
I also think it is a great question. Obviously, it also moves. It's a sign that food has moved from. In cultural significance, I think, because it's now fractured off into little sort of guerrilla cultural movements. It's like the graffiti art of a certain borough or whatever, which I happen to think is a great idea because it means that people are taking the things we're talking about seriously and they're not just about showy class and status and that kind of stuff. Other good questions, please. There's one in the back.
I would like to take on the title of this event. I am always surprised by titles like this, right? Farewell to Canals or The Last Days of Haute Cuisine and so many like that. And it turns out never to be true. So it's actually very symptomatic of this anxiety of New York and the United States vis-a-vis the Western powers, in this case, France, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So are we really saying farewell here? Can we really say farewell while we keep on using their categories of knowledge as our model, as our standard, right? Why is it that the French definition of the restaurant is taken as the only real one, right? And then the others are deviations or novelties or not quite there yet, right? There's many different kinds of restaurants all over the world and in New York City also, these that she mentioned being some of them, right? But they're still taken as not quite there yet. So if we don't give up the idea that it's the French that have defined forever and ever what the proper restaurant is, what ought in French cuisine is, right? The whole idea of authenticity, all these categories of knowledge about cuisine are still coming from the French, right? And from the West, they have to be questioned.
And I think my answer, two short kind of sentences. One is, I really think it's a farewell, I see it as a farewell to the restaurant, as a French invention. I think what's happening, and it's going to happen, is eateries. Interesting expansion of the category of the restaurant that's already happening. I mean, the example I gave you, 20 years ago, nobody would have said Momofuku is a restaurant. Doesn't have tablecloth, you know? And so what is happening is, in some ways, all kinds of interesting inputs in it, and I think it's you're pointing rightly to a kind of an anxiety. I said two sentences, so that's it.
Anxiety, period.
I would say something, two things. One was, you know, Chesterton once said about England, he said, England doesn't have Roman ruins. It is a Roman ruin. You know, and the identity and meaning of French food will extend, I mean, like, long past the time when people, you know, don't know a quenelle from a gefilte fish, like, they'll still have the use of, I mean, you see that the menu, the per se menu, half of it is in French. Every single good restaurant, including Momofuku, is using French technique. I mean, the best cooks all have to go to the Daniel Boulud finishing school or somebody like him, crack on the whip. So that's my answer to that. The other thing I was just going to say, just drop in, is I don't think just because somebody writes on paper, it makes them smarter. So what if...
I'll argue about that.
Oops. Can you say that in the library?
That's right. No, but I would say the fact that somebody had to fight for that job as opposed to just opening up there. I don't mean you. I mean all of them. It's just sort of opening the, you know, hanging out the shingle, which is what you get to do there. Does not give them the instant credibility that I think they claim.
Great questions. Yes. Of course. Can we talk about ordering in, for those of you who didn't hear the question, is the question. Can we talk about ordering in? I know a lot of people in here probably could. Might be doing so in a few minutes.
I think Laura has the definitive, what you said about the difference between, or the perception that ordering in is convenient, whereas cooking for yourself is not, or that somehow ordering in saves time, mm-hmm. When in fact it doesn't. So therefore the reasons for ordering in have to do with other considerations. So.
You could make a good argument that that's the definitive
absolutely.
New York restaurant
I think you could.
Experience.
because you go somewhere else and you mean, what do you mean I can't have them bring it to me? That happens a lot. Jeez. Good idea. Well, we have time for a couple more.
I wanted to know what you thought about restaurants becoming more of an idea of performance art, and you feel like your waiter, Freudian Lip, is an actor, and he's on when he comes to the table, and the way the food arrives, and if that might be a new trend, if that's going to disappear, and people talking about eating out as if they were in a play.
I'm not going to answer this. I'm just going to tell a quick story, classic Mimi Sheridan story, who was the critic for the New York Times for 9 years. She had the job longer than anybody. And she was once out to dinner, famously, and asked if her waiter was an actor, and he said yes, and she said, well, why don't you act like a waiter? I mean, comments about food as performance. New York Magazine article recently about Ferran Adrià's experience, written by the art critic, tellingly. Comments?
I think this has always been true. It is also not uniquely New York. There's a sort of American performance that you see in a lot of menus, say from the Midwest in the 1950s, where they're saying, our two farm fresh eggs made into an omelet at your order, and then served with crispy garden fresh vegetables. A huge amount of kind of cheering you up and making you in the mood to order a lot of stuff. Or the Olive Garden type Red Lobster places mm-hmm. have perfected techniques of making you order more. So that the waiter is not allowed not to say to say something neutral like, do you want any dessert? But has to say, we have a lot of luscious desserts, and then enumerate them. So one of the things about some of these places, though, in New York, is that the performance is unpredictable, even if it's very irritating. It's not as sort of controlled and, your call is important to us, or this may be recorded for quality assurance. And it is, of course, a tremendous difference between the United States and Europe to this day. And it's not a question of high-end French restaurants, but French restaurants, restaurants in Spain or really anywhere that I'm familiar with other than Britain, it's partly that the waiters are professionals and that that's actually their job. And there are very few non-ethnic restaurants in New York where that's true. And some of it is that Americans, even very sophisticated Americans, place a great value on entertainment and on the experience. And don't mind interference with what ought to be just a, you know, a kind of a frictionless, noiseless experience.
I would point you to one, sorry, just one of the menus, the form of the 12 Caesars menu outside, which was one of Joe Baum's masterpieces. It's kind of the inventor. I mean, obviously he didn't invent it, but the marketer of dining as theater and dining as this sort of crazy, kitschy, you know, your waiter's dressed like a Roman, you know, in a toga with the whatever, at a very high level. I mean, that was a very expensive restaurant. So I'm sorry, you were going to say something?
I just anytime you go into a restaurant that's fancier than you are, you're going to feel like you've stepped on this stage and you maybe don't know your lines. And everything about it that, you know, somebody's going to take your coat or who is the right person to take your coat. And there are places where they come and they put your napkin on your lap for you, which I think is the worst thing I ever saw happen in a restaurant. And it's somehow, you know, you can become 10 years old and you're eating with the grown-ups in this place. And so there's a kind of performance aspect inherent just in that thing of if it's a certain kind of restaurant and you're a certain kind of person, you are definitely going to feel that way.
I must quickly, it's again, reduce things to biography. I was terrified of high-end restaurants until I went and taught at the CIA. Then I thought I came out of it with authoritative claims about standards.
I think one or two more questions, if there are any. Yes, Nida? The question was, can we talk about the popularity and inherent discomfort of communal dining and communal tables? You got a very smart audience here at the Coleman Center.
I think it's unpopular.
That's, I think, was her point.
Oh, perhaps. The unpopular?
Well, no. Yeah. Whichever way. Talk about it.
Why is it so popular?
They have communal tables everywhere, but no one wants to eat together.
Yeah.
Because the restaurants are primarily an exercise in public culture. I mean, to go and be stuck cheek by jowl is maybe a little too public. I mean, you want to go there with somebody else, and the experience of being there, like all the things you're talking about, that informs your relationship with somebody else. It shows that you're on a certain level, you have certain things in common, you both know how to play the game, whatever. You can talk about things and either not be interrupted by the bread guy or not. But I mean, that whole sort of, you know, intricate set of interactions, that doesn't, you know, that's a function of eating in a restaurant. To then be at a table with a bunch of people, I mean, it's an encounter group or a trough or something. I mean, it's something totally different. And it takes away from the experience.
Someone this morning mentioned how New Yorkers have perfected the experience of being in an elevator with a bunch of strangers and all being alone. It's not unlike that at a communal table here, I think, in some ways. And then one more question, and then we'll, yes.
What do you think about the trend or having calories put on menus? It seems so nutty.
The question is, what do we think of the trend of putting calories on menus, which seems so nutty to the questioner? And
I'd say pretty nutty. I mean, it's based on the assumption that if you educate people, they will make right choices. And
and we'll, at 9 o'clock, we'll all see that play out.
I'm a medieval historian in my day job, and you know. St. Augustine's Confessions disposed of that idea.
Although in New York, you know, what the law is that if you're a chain or if there's sort of three or more of you, then you have to list the calories. That's our current law here. I got to say, when you go into Starbucks and you see those calorie counts, it stops you in your tracks. And I think it stops a lot of people in their tracks. You often see that the, you know, this kind of humongous sort of cupcake masquerading as a muffin is just sitting there while some little dainty cookie is that's what people are ordering. So it has but I think if it belongs anywhere, it belongs in those chain places, not in a real restaurant.
I think I'm still waiting for a zero calorie fantastic meal, which is very expensive. Which is you pay a lot for nothing. Which is perfect.
The fun.
I would just add two things. We recently wrote an article about it for one of our publications, and we tried to find some people with some different experiences. And someone we interviewed said they went to go get their Rice Krispie Square, and when they saw that it had 700 calories and the grilled cheese with two eggs and whatever only had 650, that's what they took. So it can go both ways. And the other is that if people knew the calories of food in restaurants, there'd be a lot less eating out. If they really knew, everyone orders the fish in a French restaurant because the meat is going to be so fattening. And then you read Thomas Keller's recipe for sea bass, which involves poaching it for 7.5 days in butter, and then So anyway, I think it's great. I want to let you all get out so that you can buy these people's books, communicate with them on an individual basis, and go home and see the debate and do your civic duty. So I want to thank everybody for being here.
Thank you.